titled The Centrality of Preaching and the Task of the Ministry, Dr. Killinger wrote, "There is nothing like preaching when it is imaginatively conceived and faithfully executed to bring order and meaning into a man's entire ministry. A man must have a center. He cannot be all circumference. Somewhere, somehow, things must come together. And the burden to preach, to speak the word, is such a place." Dr. Killinger has made preaching not only the center of his ministry, but of his academic life as well. He is a much sought-after lecturer and pulpit guest. He has taught homiletics at Princeton Theological Seminary, and for the past 15 years has been professor of preaching and literature at the Divinity School of Vanderbilt University. He received the BA degree from Baylor University, the MA and PhD degrees in English literature from the University of Kentucky. He did his seminary degree at Harvard University Divinity School and received his Doctor of Theology degree from Princeton. His writings have been as diverse as his education. He is the author of some 23 books, including volumes of academic literary criticism. He has written a book entitled Hemingway and the Dead Gods, which was a study of literary existentialism. He's the author of a book entitled The Failure of Theology in Modern Literature. He's also written on homiletics under such titles as the one mentioned a bit earlier, The Centrality of Preaching. He's also written a book entitled The Word Not Bound. A collection of sermons has been published under the title The Thickness of Glory. He has edited several compilations of sermons. He has also been writing a series of devotional commentaries on the Gospels, many of which have already appeared. And in more recent years, he has concentrated on the art of communication and interpersonal relations with such books as For God's Sake, Be Human, and All You Lonely People, All You Lovely People. He emerged some years ago in the forefront of an experimental movement in talking about the theology of preaching. He wrote a book on experimental worship entitled Leave It to the Spirit. And he is going to be sharing with us today some insights regarding various forms in which preaching can perhaps take shape in an endeavor to preach the gospel to contemporary man. It's a pleasure to have Dr. Killinger with us.
Thank you, John. It's a delight to be here. I know John warned me ahead of time that he wasn't sure whether you were here for me or because you have such good Danish on these occasions. I told him I was astounded at the munificence of this seminary in providing this kind of treat. It's a little bit suspicious. You think of bread and circuses and that sort of thing. And we always talk about getting people to church for a biscuit. But it's great to be here and to share this occasion with you. I want to talk this morning about something that is very much in the forefront of homiletical theory today, and that is the subject of story preaching, but to talk also about other forms of preaching before we get through. Speaking of stories, I was down in Georgia for a Methodist pastor school a few months ago, and met an English teacher who had an exasperating experience with one of his students who had turned in a perfectly horrible paper. I don't know if you ever do that here, but the English professor had written a remark in the corner of the paper which I've been unable to eradicate from my mind and have been tempted to duplicate several times on some of my own student papers. He said in the corner of the paper, he said, "Sir, your vocabulary is mean and impoverished, but it is perfectly adequate to express your thoughts." I do not know that my vocabulary is adequate to express my thoughts or my joy of being with you, but I'm delighted. I'm delighted to see John again, and in this context and behind the beard, I've seen John briefly when he came through Vanderbilt recently wearing a beard. He came to my office door, and I didn't recognize him at all behind that. I suppose you would call that a subterfuge. But I was delighted to have dinner with him and Ruth Ann last night. We had a lovely time and were able to reminisce, which is something some of you are getting old enough to begin doing. I was in England a couple of years ago on sabbatical and had some time to read things that I normally don't read at home. In fact, one of the great delights of taking a sabbatical in England is the English bookstores. We were in Oxford, and many of you have probably been acquainted with Blackwell's, which is undoubtedly a kind of paradise for any kind of bibliophile. We used to walk downtown to get the daily groceries. You had a little refrigerator about so high, so you always went daily for the various kind of things you needed. And invariably ended up stopping at W.H. Smith's or Blackwell's or somewhere just to peruse the latest books. And one of the things that I read that year, the kind of serendipitous experience, was a biography, an autobiography by Sir Francis Chichester, the famous explorer who sailed that little boat, the Gypsy Moth, around the world. And it was a biography called The Lonely Sea and the Sky. And I was interested to learn that Chichester, before he became a boatsman, was a pilot, that he had had an airplane back in the days of the early flights across the Atlantic. He wished that he had been the first to fly the Atlantic, but inasmuch as he wasn't, he decided he would be the first to fly the Tasmanian Sea, that particularly stormy area between New Zealand and Australia. He had a small plane that was called Gypsy Moth, the precursor of the little boat that became so famous. And this plane was so small that it was not equipped to fly that distance. It didn't have the petrol tanks to make it that far. So he had to plan, when he started across that sea, to stop somewhere en route. He consulted his maps and found that there was one small island that would have a field on it large enough to land on. It was Norfolk Island, out in the middle of the water. The only problem was that in those days there were no sophisticated navigation equipments, and the only thing he could do was to use a sextant to find his way for that very small island. It was something like a mile in diameter. And he had to find it rather precisely, because if he missed it, he would not have enough gasoline to continue his flight and would end up somewhere in that stormy sea. So there's a marvelous scene in the book which is described by Chichester as he flies out across the sea on his way to the Norfolk Island, trying to reach Australia from New Zealand. He didn't plan on one thing, which he should have planned on as a seasoned traveler, and that was that the sky might turn suddenly overcast and there wouldn't be any way of seeing the sun to take his bearings. And so as he found his way out across the Tasmanian Sea, being swept by the wind so that it was impossible to stay directly on course, with the clouds filling in overhead, he began to feel a sense of panic about where he was going. As he made his way as faithfully as he could along the course he had originally charted, he suddenly was delighted to see that somewhere in the distance the clouds were breaking and the sun was coming through. And so, abandoning the course which he had set for himself, Chichester turned his little plane and headed directly toward the open spot in the clouds, got out his sextant. He held the throttle between his knees while he operated the sextant in his hands and took his bearings, put the plane back on course toward Norfolk Island, and headed out again under the clouds. Again and again he did that on the course of his trip. He would see a break here and there. He would head for the break. He would get out his sextant, take his bearings again, and get on course. And eventually he dropped down right atop that little island and was able to refuel and make his way on to Australia. I thought as I read that, and this is the preacher in me, I suppose, I thought how illustrative that is of the way we are in our theological lives, that we go from one sunspot to another through a sea that is rough and under clouds that sometimes hide all visibility of the sun or any other directive instrument. We make our way from one place to another where we feel a moment of surety and can set our small crafts in the right direction once more and head toward the goal, whatever the goal in life for us may be. And I think this is very true for most of us who are ministers and who are students of the gospel and who are becoming ministers. That if we look back across our lives, we realize that it has not been one straight way, that the evolution of who we are and what we have become has not been something that was not occasioned by turnings and by various conversions along the way, but that instead it was something characterized by moments of illumination, which enabled us to go from one place in life to another place with a sense that at last, again, we were on course. And then just as we were about to become uncertain of where we were, when it seemed that all of the fog of life had closed in on us, and in that mistiness we were merely groping around and felt totally confused and unable to go forward, suddenly the clouds broke open and we had a shaft of sunlight and we headed toward it and were saved. Now, what I'm talking about basically is the story character of who we are as theologians and ministers, and of who our people are to whom we minister and to whom we preach in life. That life is not a perfectly analyzable, computable kind of thing. That instead it is a groping, an evolution, a movement. It is a journey, a pilgrimage. It is a reaching out for those things that we are not able to describe or to know until we think we have touched them. And then once we have touched them, we cannot always describe them because they are sometimes left in mystery. And we realize that life itself is mystery. Now, you may remember a few years ago, some of you are old enough to have been fans of Sam Keen, who is now an editor for Psychology Today. Sam used to be a professor of theology up at Louisville Presbyterian Seminary in Kentucky. And Sam was a very rigid, systematic kind of theologian, as some Presbyterians are. Sam had gone to school at Maryville College in his hometown, Maryville, Tennessee. He'd gone from there to Princeton University and taken a doctorate in systematic theology. And he was about as straight as a theologian could be. But then Sam realized that in that straightness, in the well-defined regions in which he worked, in the careful analysis of doctrine and philosophy and all the rest in his teaching areas, Sam realized that there wasn't any juice left for him, that somehow there wasn't any life there, that he was missing something in all of that he was too regimented, that his life was too routinized. Sam left the seminary on a sabbatical and went out to California. He went about as far away from Louisville Presbyterian Seminary as one could go in the world because he went to Esalen Institute. And he went out there and he sat in some of those thermal baths, had nude bathing and Roffing. You remember Ida Roff, the famous woman therapist who believed that there are certain focal points in the body where the various things that are wrong with us become crystallized, and therefore she combined psychological counseling with a kind of deep, penetrating kind of massage, which is very painful. Sam went through that. He sat a lot by the ocean and listened to the waves. He watched the seagulls. He felt the breeze, and he thought back on his life and on the theological career he had been through. And while he was doing that, he wrote a rather remarkable autobiographical book called To an Answering God. And one of the statements in that book that fairly leapt out at me when I read it was this one. He said, "If I am to rediscover the holy, it must be in my biography and not in the history of Israel. If I am to rediscover the holy, it must be in my biography and not in the history of Israel." Now, what Sam was expressing was this bifurcation that often occurs in our lives, particularly when we're in seminary, between the doctrinal studies that we have to go through, the analysis of faith, the philosophy, and the theology of what we're about, and where we're actually living at the same time. And when the bifurcation occurs, you know, we get confused about where the course is. Sometimes we don't see the light anymore. We don't feel the mystery. We become hungry for some spirit that has not touched our lives lately. And even though we are growing and becoming a different kind of person, at the same time, there's this missing of the juices that Sam felt in his own case. And then when that happens, we begin to realize that there is something missing for us in the history of Israel, and we must rediscover who we are, where the centers of our own beings are. And there comes a time when we have to pull off from where we are, to get away, take a vacation, to go up in the North Woods, to fish, to bum around the world, or do something to allow who we are to obtain again, to find the center. A center of gravity, a kind of density of being that we have not felt lately. Now, I think seminary tends to make most of us analytical. I mean, we come here, this is the job of the professor, to force us to analyze, to think, to compute, to calculate. They're working on the left side of the brain, that is the computative side, the analytical side. And this is necessary. But some of us submit to that so thoroughly that we forget that life is a story, that we are important in our own way, and that our experiences are important. We begin to attribute far more more importance to the lives and the values of certain theologians and ethicists and sociologists than we do to our own developing lives. Or maybe we neglect the development of our own lives so that those things take on an unusual importance to us. And maybe we need to be reminded, as Frederick Buechner reminded us a few years ago in his little book, The Alphabet of Grace, that all theology, before it is theology, is autobiography. That Aquinas and Calvin and Tillich and anybody else you want to name was merely writing out the story of his life, trying to make sense of it. That if you scratch any theologian very deeply, what you're likely to come upon is some person who weeps and has joy and who loves children or who is lonely or who feels that he is being neglected by his colleagues. There are all kinds of human factors involved in theology. And maybe if those scandalous books by Rollo May and Paul Tillich's wife that appeared a few years ago, attempting to expose the kind of man Tillich was, maybe if those books had any real purpose, it was to remind us that the Tillich, who was writing a systematic theology, was trying to understand God in terms of his own existential needs as a person. And therefore, perhaps we ought to give more attention to our own stories and the stories of other people as we study theology and as we think about what we're doing when we prepare to preach the gospel in churches. I think it is a sad thing that we go through a period in our lives when there is so much being taken into our lives, so much being ingested, that we don't have time to digest it. I've watched this now for 15 years in seminary. I don't think I have ever been quite acculturated to seminary, and therefore I continue to see this. But what I see is students who come and spend 3 or 4, or in some cases 5 years, if they're unusually dependent persons and don't want to get out in the parish too soon. I see them come, and when they come, they are fresh and vital, and their fears and their joys show in their eyes. But they learn to control this. By the time they get to be middlers or seniors, there's a kind of steeliness that has replaced this. And they are able to look as if they are in charge of the world, when very much, in fact, they are not in charge of the world. And when they get up to preach in preaching classes, I find it so disconcerting that they have lost the ability to deal in story, their stories. For over and over, the one thing I find now I must continually remind my students of is that they're making a witness when they preach, and that there is something of their own personality and their own pilgrimage that has got to be there in what they are saying, or it is not authentic to people. That they cannot get up and quote Schleiermacher and Bultmann and Tilly, they cannot simply exegete a passage with all the correctness and precision that they have been taught in seminary and expect that to be preaching. That unless there is what D.H. Lawrence called the passion, that blood passion, that feeling that something has drastically affected their lives and is affecting their lives and could affect the lives of their hearers, then the sermons don't quite come alive. So I want to talk to you a few minutes this morning about two or three things that I think we need to consider when we're considering the task of preaching. I understand many of you have just gotten your appointments for next year, and there's been a lot of excitement and I'm sure some disappointment in appointments. But as you prepare to go out and as you are going to be dealing with human lives, you're on the other end of the stick as you speak from your end of it, I'd like to suggest two or three things that I think you ought to remember about preaching when you're out there. The first thing I would like to say is that it is very important to probe the text on which you preach. And I know coming from this seminary, you're all going to be good textual preachers, that you probe the text on which you preach until you reach through to the human dimensions in the text themselves, until you discover the stories that underlay the text upon which you preach. I think it is so sad that some of the best biblical scholars who come through our seminary at Vanderbilt are often the persons who are unable to see the human dimension behind the scriptures they're dealing with. They cannot somehow get back beyond the Greek or the Hebrew, beyond the participial phrases and all of that, to see the real live human context out of which these things made meaning and sense originally. They tend to take a little verse of scripture or maybe a passage of scripture and to exegete it, and really what they're doing is macerating it, you know, getting it so fine, so chopped up that it has no life anymore. And they're unable totally to revivify and represent the situation in which something occurred. For example, I shouldn't be talking about things like this in the presence of these biblical scholars here, but I've learned they're human too. And Mark 6 to Mark 8, three chapters in Mark's gospel. Mark 6 has the story of the feeding of the 5,000. Mark 8 has the story of the feeding of the 4,000. I have found that my students, when they preach on either one of these texts, will often get up and they'll begin by commenting on the fact that Mark has a doublet account of the feeding miracle, and that in one of them there were 5,000 people who were fed, and the other there were 4,000 people who were fed. And in one of them there were 5 loaves that were used for the miracle, and in the other there were 7 loaves that were used. And in the first miracle there were 12 baskets full left over, and in the second one there were 7 baskets full left over. And then they make the conclusion, which they often have read in commentaries, I'm sure, that really what Mark was doing here was being uncertain about which account to put in. So rather than put in the wrong one, you know, it had come down by dual carriageway, he put both of them in there in order to be on the safe side. And really, they're probably two versions of the same story. Well, now that's beautiful analysis, and it sounds impressive to lay audiences and probably sends them home convinced that none of them can ever understand the Bible and they probably shouldn't read it. But, you know, if you linger over those chapters a little bit, you begin to see some literary tie-ins, some things that come out of the background of the author's life and what the author is driving at in terms of the human story. Because in between those chapters, in the 7th chapter, is that marvelous story about the Syrophoenician woman who came to Jesus asking a miracle for her daughter. You remember that Jesus told her that you don't give the children's bread to the dogs. And the woman says to him in good rabbinical fashion, but sir, she says, even the little dogs under the table, little house dogs, are able to catch the crumbs that the children allow to fall. And Jesus vested in rabbinical argument and always happy with people who could do that, I suppose. Jesus gives her what she wants. Well, now, are these isolated accounts? We're dealing with bread here again, you see. And the Syrophoenician woman is Jesus' first encounter in the Gospel of Mark with somebody who is not a Jew. He is moving out of the Jewish territories into the other territories around Judea. And when he moves out, he begins again to deal with people in a similar fashion to the way he has dealt with the Jews. But this time, when he feeds a crowd up in the Decapolis, it is the miracle has different numbers in it. And any numerologist among your commentators will tell you that in the first instance, in the feeding in chapter 6, you're dealing with Jewish numerology. You've got five loaves, and there are, five loaves. You've got 12 baskets full left over for the 12 tribes of Israel, 5,000 people. But when you get up in the non-Jewish territory, you've got 4,000 people, kind of a symbol of the four corners of the earth, perhaps. You've got seven loaves and seven baskets full, and you remember that the number seven had to do with fullness, and there were 70 nations of the earth in the Jewish mind. What you're dealing with is a miracle that was given to the Jews, and now it's being given to the Gentiles, and you've got this Syrophoenician woman as a bridge between them. And along with it, you've got all this business about the disciples and how they couldn't see what they were about. Mark, you know, is constantly talking about being able to see and to understand. And shortly after the second miracle, Jesus and the disciples are in a boat going across the lake, and the disciples fall into an argument because they realize they haven't brought enough bread with them. And they begin to probably argue about whose responsibility it was. They have only one loaf in the boat. And Jesus, perceiving what they're arguing about, Jesus says to them, "How long do I have to be with you before you see?" He said, "When I fed the 5,000, how many baskets full of fragments did you pick up?" And they said, 12. "And when I fed the 4,000, how many baskets full did you pick up?" And they said, 7. He said, "Don't you see? You have eyes to see, but you don't see, and ears to hear, but you don't hear." And then you pick up that little word from Jesus, and you go back here, and over there in the 6th or 7th chapter, there's a story of a deaf man that Jesus had made to hear again, and touched his mouth so that the man who had an impediment of speech could not only hear but could speak. And then in the 8th chapter, you go on to the story of the blind man. You've got one dealing with hearing, another dealing with seeing. A blind man who couldn't see anything came to Jesus, and Jesus, you remember, made a little spittle and put a little mud on his eyes, and then he asked him what he could see. And the man looked around and he said, "I see men like trees walking." And again, Jesus touched his eyes, and this time the man could see clearly when he looked. He could see clearly. The only miracle Jesus ever did twice. Now, why would Mark put something like that in his gospel? The only miracle Jesus ever had to do twice. Instantly it happened whenever Jesus did it. Or was Mark trying to say something here about seeing, being able to perceive? Was this part of what this whole section is about? Being able to see that the master who fed the people in the wilderness is always with his people, even in a boat where there isn't any bread, and that Jesus is able to feed his church in the boat or in the wilderness. And that when we don't see very well, Jesus can touch our eyes again and make us see better than we were seeing. Yeah, it's rich, you see. You don't just deal with the Greek. You don't just deal with the nuances of the textual matters. But you get back to the whole life picture, to the literary picture behind it that talks about human life. Because what you find out is that their human life is very much like our human life. And if you can understand what the human dimensions of this were, you can probably preach this text in a way so that people can appropriate it in our own time. Take one other text this morning. Over in John's Gospel, there's a little text in the 7th chapter, the 37th, 39th verses. On the last day of the feast, the great day, Jesus stood up and proclaimed, "If anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink. He who believes in me, as the scripture has said, out of his heart shall flow rivers of living water. Now this he said about the Spirit, which those who believed in him were to receive, for as yet the Spirit had not been given, because Jesus was not yet glorified. Now, you know, that's an easy text to preach on. You read the Greek, you study it a little bit, and it's easy enough to get up and talk about Jesus as the source of living waters, and how any of us who believe on him will become the source of these rivers of living water. But when you begin imaginatively to probe the human depths of the Gospel of John, and to see all of the things that John was trying to link up in a literary way, like the fact that when Jesus was crucified, John represents the soldier as having thrust the spear in his side so that blood and water came from his side, the only account in the Gospels of this. You begin to realize that John may have had something in mind in relating that here to the rivers of living water that shall flow from the one who believes in Christ. And when you do your exegetical studies and your commentary studies and get back to the original source of what was happening here and realize that this feast was a time of dedication among the people when they were when they had a rite that celebrated water. It's a feast of tabernacles that recalls the journeys of the Israelites through the wilderness, and you remember the importance of water in the wilderness, and how every time they had this feast, every day of the feast, they had a procession that went down from the temple down to the little fountain of Gihon down on the side of the hill, and the priest would carry a golden pitcher from the temple down there and would fill that pitcher from the fountain of Gihon while the people were chanting from the Psalms, the Hallel Psalms particularly. And then they would carry that pitcher back up the hill to the temple, and they would circle the altar. And when they had circled the altar, the priest would pour that water into a silver funnel that carried it down under the altar and let the water run out into the ground again as a symbol of God's providing water for the people in the wilderness. When you realize that John is saying here, this is the last day of the feast, the great day, and that on that day they not only made the procession down to the fountain, but they came back and circled the altar seven times before they poured the water, and that it was at this occasion that Jesus stood up, perhaps on the pediments of the temple, and shouted out. The verb there, to cry out, is the same one that is used for John the Baptist crying in the wilderness. That Jesus shouted out that anyone who was thirsty could come to him to drink, and that out of those who believed in him would flow rivers of living waters to the people. You get a picture of the human dimension of what was happening there, of the excitement that the author of this gospel must have felt as he was writing these words. It is not some dry text. It is not something that ought to be left in dryness, that ought to be treated with mere analysis. It is something that ought to be given the most pictorial setting possible so that people can see it and hear it again, so that their lives may be changed by the dimension of the text itself. And if you're good enough at this sort of thing, you can do it even for the book of Leviticus. You can find ways of enlivening and finding the human dimensions of the laws that seem so tedious and so dry and so monotonous to us today. Realize that somehow this was part and parcel of people's life dimensions, and get those into the sermon. The first thing is to probe the text imaginatively until you find the human level of the text and aren't dealing merely with an analysis of the verbal part of the text. Then the second thing you need to do as pastors is to probe the lives of your people until you've heard their stories, until you've really listened to who they are. John may recall that one of the things I've normally had students do in homiletics classes at Vanderbilt is to use a worksheet in which they work from the text to the sermon, and on the way they have to describe something that we call the point of contact. And the point of contact is simply the moment of intersection between the text and the lives of the hearers. It has to do with some things in the lives of the hearers that would make them susceptible of hearing the text. Some of the things that describe who they are as people. Some of their agony, some of the joy, some of the problems, some of the things they're preoccupied with when they come into the setting of the sanctuary. And getting those things somehow into the sermon itself, so at the very forefront of the sermon, there is an identification of their needs in the text. I don't know if you have ever seen a magazine called Books and Bulletins. That's a lovely magazine. If you're ever in Foyle's bookshop in London, ask them to send this magazine to you. They send it free of charge. It's one of the most delightful review books that comes out everywhere in the world. And even though I haven't bought anything from Foyle's in 12 years, they still send me the magazine. Now, I don't know how they do it. It's kind of like all this pastry around here, I guess. But they're great about it, and they have absolutely scintillating reviews. And one of my favorite reviewers in this magazine, Books and Bookmen, is Oberon Wolf, who is an acerbic reviewer, if there ever was one. You know, American reviewers tend to sort of shadowbox with authors and try to say nice, polite things about books. Well, Oberon Wolf, he loves to take books apart. He flays the authors. And I'll never forget one review that appeared 3 or 4 years ago. It was a double review. He was reviewing a recent book by the Archbishop of Canterbury, who was Norma Coggin at the time, which was called Dear Archbishop. It concerned letters that had been sent to the Archbishop and his responses to them. And in the same review, a book called Dear Marge. Now, Marge happened to be Marjorie Proops, who was a columnist, a lovelorn columnist for the London Daily Mirror. Now, these are two rather unlikely books to be yoked together in a single review. But it was a brilliant review, because what Wolf had to say was that he found in the Archbishop's book a lot of pedantry, a lot of interest in false issues, and a treatment of people as if they were idiots or small children. While in Dear Marge's book, he found a treatment of people as if they were real and as if their problems were really agonizing problems, and as if they were worthy of all the respect and the reverence that she could muster in trying to help them face and deal with their problems. And he really cut Donald Coggin's book to shreds. As a matter of fact, he said that before he got through, he said sometimes he said, all right, and in all, he was a Roman, he's a Roman Catholic. He said, in all of the higgledy-piggledy, niggling, novelty-mad fanaticism of Rome, I'm tempted to join the Church of England. But he said, in the future, I shall keep this book, the Archbishop's book, on my bedside at night, in case I'm ever seized by a mad impulse in the middle of the night, it will stop me from doing it. I think he made a very telling point. That sometimes, as ministers, we become artificial in the way we loosen to people's problems. We don't really hear what they're saying. Because we've got some answers, we sort of leap to conclusions about what they need. There was this whole thing a few years ago. I was a Southern Baptist one time, and a few years ago, the Southern Baptists were putting billboards up all over the country, you know, Christ is the answer. And nobody ever bothered to ask the question. And this is the way we are as ministers, you know. We've got the answers. And they're all dressed up in clerical black and collars. And we don't really know how to listen sometimes to the hurts and the wounds and the cries of our people. But until we do that, and do it imaginatively, and begin to see how these blend in somehow with the stories in the scriptures, we really haven't got a hold of things for preaching. I was in a Presbyterian church in Nashville 3 winters ago, I think it was. I was there a couple of weeks before Christmas, and I knew a lot of people in the church, and as I visited with them, I heard from them the stories of various things that were going on in people's lives in the congregation. And I was amazed at how much hurt there was in one small congregation. It was only half the size of the group in this room this morning. And I knew that among those people, there was a Vietnamese family that had been relocated in the church. And this Vietnamese family was having their first Christmas away from their family. Back in Vietnam, the street names had been changed in their village. And their family names had been changed so that there was no possibility of their ever corresponding with those loved ones again. And they were sitting there in the congregation. There was a woman there whom I knew personally to be dying of cancer. She and her husband were sitting there during the service, looking up hungrily for any word that might be spoken. There was a young man in the congregation who had just failed his exams and was dropping out of school. There was a couple there who had lost their daughter by suicide a year before. There was a man whose business was failing. And I was so moved by this feeling that I had for these people that I went back to that church the next Sunday to hear the preacher's sermon. I went back to worship, but I especially wanted to hear the minister's sermon. Because I thought, the minister who deals with these people is going to have a word of gospel on this Sunday before Christmas. And I went back there and listened to a sermon that sailed about 10 feet over the heads of these people, that dealt with some artificial and trivial little theme about Christmas, but never really touched where they were suffering or hurting at all. And I came away so depressed that I think I could have committed suicide. If I didn't understand how a minister could be in a small congregation like that, dealing with people like that, and get up and preach a sermon but never touched a single human need. We need to listen to the stories of our people and to probe them in order to be able to preach to them. Because at the bottom of all of our stories, there's a commonness. And that commonness begins to merge with the story in the scriptures. A few years ago, Bernard Malamud, one of the great talented Jewish novelists of our time, wrote a novel called The Fixer, which I think is probably his most enduring work. The Fixer is the story of an impecunious little Jewish tinkerer named Yaakov Bock, who lived in a small town in Russia, whose wife had left him and who had failed in business, and when the book opens, we see him preparing to leave his hometown and move to Kiev and set up business there to try to make a living. He has all of his belongings piled on a little cart that is pulled by a donkey, and we see him starting out across the barren landscape of the steppes for his new home, a lonely, isolated figure in a world of problems. When he gets to Kiev, more problems await him. There is a Russian outbreak against the Jews, a new pogrom, and they're looking for a scapegoat for the pogrom, and so they blame a murder of a small boy, which apparently was done in a ritualistic fashion, on this Jewish man who is a stranger in town, Yaakov Bock. And they put him in prison, down in the dark cells of a solitary confinement. And day after day, this poor isolated human being lives there trying to keep his sanity, trying to be alive in a world that does this to people. And then one day there's some noise. He hears the jailer bringing somebody else and putting somebody else in the cell next to his. The walls of the cells are immensely thick, and it's impossible to talk across them. But the tinkerer, the little man, the fixer, begins shouting out to his cellmate as soon as he knows the jailer has gone. He shouts out to him, and there is no response. Finally, he takes his shoe, and he beats on the wall as loudly and as vigorously as he can. Eventually, there is a little tapping noise as someone on the other side begins to respond. And then Yaakov Bock shouts again, and he begins to think he hears muffled, indistinguishable sounds of shouting on the other side. Malamud says they continued this way day and night, these two isolated individuals in their cells, as if each of them had a heart-rending story he wanted to tell the other, but couldn't get through the thickness of the walls. And I think Malamud, I said I thought that book was his enduring book because I think it reaches mythological proportions there. I think the picture he's given us of humanity is accurate. I said I thought that book was his enduring book because I think it reaches mythological proportions there. I think the picture he's given us of humanity is accurate. That the people in our parishes are people who are isolated in thick walled cells, and their hurts are so bad that they think there's nobody who can hear them. And they're crying out from time to time, trying to make contact. That's why they come to you as pastors. That's why they drop little hints. And if you read a book like William Willimon's Worship as Pastoral Care,
you begin to understand that sometimes when they complain to you about something that was done in worship, they're not just complaining. They're not just bitching about things. They are really trying to get in touch with you at some level of their lives where they're hurting. And you begin to learn to listen and pick up on these things and to minister sometimes to the devils in your congregation, to the people who bug you the most, because they've got a story that needs to be told. And when you hear this, you begin to weave this into your sermons and into your preparation of the text. And somehow something magic begins to happen in preaching. The same sort of thing that Harry Emerson Fosdick experienced. Fosdick almost committed suicide, he said, before he discovered that he could preach in such a way as to touch people where their stories were. He said that only the preacher still proceeds upon the premise that folk come to church anxiously awaiting news of what happened to the ancient Jebusites. What they come to church for is to hear what the word is for them. Now, they may hear it through the story of the ancient Jebusites, but they're interested in themselves and in their hurts and their needs. And once you begin to listen and to probe their lives and to put that together with the probings of the text, something magic happens. And this, then, is the third thing I wanted to say, that it is important to find this intersection between their story and the story of the text. Somehow to make the two come together so that they realize when they hear you preaching on the Gospel of Mark or the Gospel of John or the book of Leviticus, that somehow that's their story. And they go away from church saying, that's how I feel. And they see in what's in the Bible a paradigm for living out their lives. They see there a shaft of sunlight coming through that will enable them to set their course again in the direction that is most helpful to them. I hope you'll pardon an irreverent story. I can't resist telling it. I have a friend who is a professor of English in Baylor University. I went to see him a couple of years ago after he'd been teaching there half a dozen years, and we were sitting around one night swapping yarns. He's a great hunter and fisherman and yarn swapper. And we were swapping yarns, and he said, you know, old so-and-so, and he named a lady on the faculty who's been there since Methuselah was a youngster. And I said, yes, I remember her. He said, you know how prim and proper she is? And I said, yes, I remember that. He said, you know, one day I learned a new side of her. He said, I asked her what her favorite story in life was. And he said she blanched and then she blushed and she averted her eyes from his. And then he said shyly and demurely, she said, well, I oughtn't to tell you this, but she said, I'm from Waxahachie, Texas. And she said, there's a story about Waxahachie that I've always loved better than any other story I've ever heard or read. She said it was about the days when the traveling lyceum came to Waxahachie, the old Chautauqua days, when a wagon would roll up or people would come in on the stagecoach who were actors and actresses and musicians or readers and lecturers. And she said it was our only contact with the outside world. And one day, on this Lyceum circuit, there came a little play to Waxahachie. And it was an exciting moment for everybody in town when a play came to town. And she said there was one woman in the play. Back in those days, she said down in Texas, women weren't in plays very much, certainly not local women. And she said there were not many actresses who traveled that way, but there was one woman in this play. And said she had the leading female part in the play. And said when she came to town, she was stricken with some illness, and she had to go to bed, and she was not going to be able to be in the play. And people were desperate. They tried to cancel the play, and the townspeople said, you can't do that. So they said, well, we'll have to find a replacement. But in a place like Waxahachie, you didn't just walk up to any lady and say, would you be in a play? That was not considered proper. So they went down to the local bar, the only bar in town, and they recruited a local woman who was known to others at the bar to be in the play. And it was a very simple kind of play. It was a melodrama, and they coached her in the few lines that she had to speak. And the main thing that she had to do was to die dramatically in the play, because the villain was to shoot her in the play, and she was to collapse on the floor. Well, they coached her in doing this, and came the night of the play, and all the local gentry or non-gentry were there for the play. And there was a sense of electricity in the air, and the curtains parted, and here was this local woman in the play, and there was a double sense of excitement about all of it. And then came the moment when the villain pulled out his gun and fired it and shot the woman, and she gave a very dramatic gasp and clutched her heart and fell to the floor. And just at that moment, someone else in the play spoke the line to the villain in which the villain himself said, "What have I done? What have I done?" And at that moment, from the back of the room, there leapt up a cowboy who had been so engrossed in the play that he shouted out, "You fool, you've shot the only whore in Waxahachie." I wouldn't advise telling that story in your churches, but I want you to see the point. It's the becoming engrossed in the story to the point where it becomes our story, you see. Or somehow it's so real. The human dimensions are so total that people are involved in it and they hear the gospel as if for the first time, as if they were the New Testament church, as if Jesus himself were right in our midst, as if they could reach out and touch the wounds in the side and the hands, and they had a sense of the risen Christ right there ministering, and as John's gospel puts it, could feel Christ breathing on them and saying, "Receive the Holy Spirit." Now, one final word, and it has to do with finding forms for doing this. How do you do it? You don't, you know, I am impressed by the fact that the old 3 points in a deathbed story, organization of a sermon, has survived for centuries. That it has essentially come down to us unchanged from the days of the 4th century, let's say. That Luther himself found it a magnificent form for the sermon, and that other reformers did. And that people today still use it with great effectiveness. So I'm not going to say anything at all to put down the old 3 points and deathbed story kind of organization of the sermon. I think if you use the traditional form of the sermon, what you want to do is to realize the story potential in that and to use the story potential to the fullest. But I think it's also important as you preach and as you probe the human dimensions of the texts and of your people and see how these things somehow are confluent and come together, that you listen to what's happening in all of this with the kind of poet's imagination that will permit you, at least from time to time, if not regularly, to create a sermon that has a different form from the one that we have traditionally used. One that somehow expresses precisely what you're dealing with, or that does it in such a way that enables people to become involved better than a didactic sermon would. I'm not going to talk much about this because I want to point you to a book that's done by a fellow Lutheran, Richard Jensen of Dubuque, who has published a recent book called Telling the Story, a very fine book on sermons and what one systematic theologian has come to discover about the importance of story in sermon. Jensen says that there are basically 3 types of sermons. The first is the didactic type. And in this type, we're basically telling people what things mean. Over and over again, we use the words, "this means," or "this signifies," or "this symbolizes," to convey meaning. It's a teaching kind of sermon. The second kind of sermon, he says, is the proclamatory sermon, the one we have learned to do out of the Neo-Orthodox movement in this century, and one which Jensen in his research in Luther says Luther was doing. A kind of sermon in which we preach the text as though it were addressed to our people and not to some people long ago. And Jensen, of course, believes that this is a much stronger kind of preaching than the kind that was didactic. But there's a third kind, says Jensen, and that is telling stories, parables for our time, which allow people to get on the inside of them the way Jesus entrapped people in his own parables. So that people listen and they identify with the process of what's happening in the story. and then when they have identified, can't get loose from it without reaching the conclusions of the story for themselves. And the beautiful thing about Jensen's book is that at the conclusion of each of these three sections on these three types of preaching, he gives some of his own sermons as examples. And all of them, or most of them, are based on the parable of the prodigal son, the story from Luke 15, so that you can compare the various kinds of preaching and their effectiveness. And I challenge you to look at those and see if you don't agree with me that he is right, that the story sermon at the end is more powerful than the others. But Jensen himself is convinced, and I think more and more people are becoming convinced today, that there is a self-will not only to the text and not only to our people's lives, but to sermons. And that when you get what's happening in people's lives together with the text, that it means that the sermon needs to take a certain kind of form on its own. Because we all know that form and meaning are inextricably wedded. That to make things fit a certain form will change the meaning, at least slightly. You know, if a person is going to write a haiku, it means that what he says is going to be quite different from what he would have said had he written a sonnet, or had he written a lyrical ballad or something like that. If an artist is painting a watercolor that is 12 by 14, it's going to make a great deal of difference between what the artist does there and what the artist would do if the artist were working in acrylics or in oils on a much larger canvas. And the same thing is true with any sermon, that there is a self-will to the sermon. And as poet preachers, we learn to listen to the material and imaginatively come up with a kind of sermon that will capture the attention and the needs of the people. I was in a church last week up in Virginia preaching, and I heard such wonderful things about the sermon that the minister there had preached on Palm Sunday, the Sunday before Easter. He had preached a monologue sermon, a dramatic monologue, and he had envisioned his own being in the crowd when Jesus arrived in Jerusalem that day. And he put himself in the place of the Jewish leaders, and he talked to the people about why this man should be crucified. And they listened to it, and they got caught up in it. And they said to me afterwards, these were business leaders, mind you. These weren't school children who were caught up in a story. These were leaders of industry and people who are extremely intelligent. They said, you know, we sat there trembling because we could see why Jesus was crucified and how we crucify him in our own lives for our own expedient reasons. It's the first time that preacher had ever tried that kind of sermon. It won't be long till he tries it again because there was such response to it. A couple of other brief examples and I'll stop. Richard Sprague, one of our students at Vanderbilt a few years ago, went out to a pastor in Washington State. He sent me a copy of a sermon he preached out there, which I thought was a beautiful job, in which he tried to deal with some analytical matters. He was trying to put some of Tillich's systematic theology across to the people in his congregation. And he began preaching the sermon by quoting Tillich. And you've read Tillich. You know how opaque Tillich is to the average person. And I had an office next to Tillich's for one quarter at the University of Chicago. He'd been my professor, and I thought he walked about that high above the waters, you know, didn't even get his feet wet. And I had a marvelous experience one day sitting in my office one afternoon when his secretary was gone. He was the only faculty member who had a secretary. And he was sitting there, and the phone rang, and he had to answer the phone himself. First time I'd ever heard him do it. And through the cinder block wall, I heard him answer in that heavy Teutonic dialect of his. I heard him say, "Hello, this is myself." And I thought how appropriate that was to Tillich. But Rick was going to preach Tillich to his people. He began reading a little Tillich and talking about Tillich. And suddenly a voice came over the PA system and interrupted him. And the voice said, "Hey, what are you trying to do to those people?" Rick stopped and he looked around. He didn't see the origin of the voice. He said, "Who is that?" And he started his sermon again. And again the voice came. And then he recognized, of course he knew it all along, but people recognized it was his voice. And he had pre-recorded it, and it was coming through the PA system. And he carried on a dialogue with this voice that was coming through the system on a tape. in which he argued for the validity of what he was trying to do with Tillich. And this other voice said, but those people don't understand Tillich. Tillich was a high-class theologian, and Tillich fought in convoluted circles and things, and people don't grasp Tillich that easily. And they kept arguing until finally the preacher got to the point where he was rephrasing Tillich in terms of those people's lives. And the voice said, well, I agree with that. And Rick said, well, that's all I was trying to say. Well, why didn't you say it like that? The voice said. And people have never forgotten the sermon, you know. They heard it. They heard it being told in terms of their own stories, and they came out of it not only with an understanding of the gospel through Tillich, but with an understanding for Tillich himself, an appreciation they'd never had before. We had another student at Vanderbilt, Pat Ellis, who was a Baptist. Rick was a Methodist. Pat preached a sermon in our chapel one day on the Good Samaritan, and he posed as a dry-as-dust professor, giving a lecture on the Good Samaritan for a sermon. And he had his spectacles down on his nose, and he was reading at his mind down in his manuscript, and he wasn't looking up at all. And as he was going along talking about the parable of the Good Samaritan and what it means, a didactic sermon, there came an interruption. Somebody stood up over here in the congregation and said, Pastor, I hate to interrupt you, but said, I'm just grieving myself to death. My mother is dying of cancer. What can I do? And he looked up, apparently befuddled by the interruption, and said, well, he said, I think we have a minister for counseling, and went back to his manuscript. And he preached a little bit longer, or spoke a little longer, and somebody over here, a small boy, stood up and said, Pastor, I don't want to interrupt what you're doing. He said, I know what you're doing is important, and what I have to say isn't, but he said, I'm new in town, and I'm lonely. I don't have many friends to play with. And again, this bespectacled fellow looked up and looked around for the origin of the wee voice over here. And when he had located it, he said to the young man, he said, I think we're going to have a new youth director in 3 months. And went back to his manuscript. He was interrupted about 3-4 times. Finally, there was one interruption when somebody came down the nave of the aisle of the church and from outside shouting, Pastor, Pastor, there's a fellow out here in the parking lot who's been run over. Something's happened to him. I think he's dying. The pastor looked up and again, apparently irritated by this time because of all the interruptions, said, oh, yes. He said, somebody did report that to me before church and I meant to make a note of it, but I forgot it. The sermon was beautiful because we all sat there getting into it. We realized that we sit around in church and talk about the Good Samaritan and that right at the very moment, there are people all around us who are hurt and wounded and dying by the roadside the way that man was. We're waiting for somebody to come along and to touch them and to pick them up and to take them into an inn and to pay their bills because they can't face it anymore. All I'm saying is, you know, that the world is a big, beautiful place where you can experience all kinds of things. And that if you use your imaginations, there is nothing richer in life for you to do than to be a pastor and a preacher. And to deal with this gospel that is so alive with meaning and so vibrant with all kinds of overtones about life, to deal with it in such a way that you pick up on the vibrations of your people and bring them together, and that the story there becomes our story. The story becomes our story, and in that story, we all become the people of God, the community of Christ, and we're able to share our health and our joy with one another and have real communion through preaching. Now, I've talked longer than I meant to, but that's something that's endemic to being a professor. Excuse me, colleague. And I'll be glad, if I may, to entertain any questions or to hear from you if you have anything you'd like to say. Was it David Brinkley or someone who recently was speaking somewhere and he asked for questions and none came, and he said, the first question is always the hardest. Let's go on to the second one. Does anybody have a second question? I think the important thing is to have one single point
that stands out over all others, though I think that we often, if in telling stories in particular, we often miss opportunities to use the richness of asides in telling stories. I think about Henry Ward Beecher in the days of slavery. Henry Ward Beecher knew that preaching against slavery was controversial in his congregation, so he never preached against slavery. But whenever he told a story, used an illustration, he always managed somehow to have some incident in it in which there was some wronged person or perhaps some black person who figured in it who was being unjustly treated. And he made his point in the asides of his stories. And I think often we can deal with issues in our churches that way in very telling, in a very telling manner. But I think whether it is a parable or a more or less a straightforward kind of sermon, a proclamatory sermon, I think it's important that everything focus on a single idea. Most of our people are not able to deal with two or three ideas in one sermon, and we're certainly not able to do it effectively and communicate it effectively. We may have a developmental sermon in which we have two, three, or four points, but even those ought to be reflections of the same point we're trying to get across. We ought, when we sit down to write the sermon, and I trust that all of you will write your sermons for at least 5 years when you leave seminary, when we sit down to write the sermon, we ought to be able, before we begin the sermon, to say, what am I trying to do to these people in this sermon? And to say it very clearly, very pungently in one sentence, and then to aim everything in the sermon in that direction. That makes an effective sermon. Yes? I think that basically, I don't think of exceptions to that at the moment. I think that's true. I think, as I said, that asides in the stories can be meaningful. Yes?
When you are trying to imaginatively reconstruct the story out of which the text arose, is there a point in preaching where imagination can run wild? And, you know, and I imagine the reaction of the disciples to this particular instance.
Right.
And trying the sermon to recreate that.
That's true. I think that the degree to which we will use our imagination in reconstructing a textual situation has to do with our personalities. Some people are more expansive than others, and they can get by with more expansive interpretations. I think what you have to do is something that has some integrity in terms of who you are as a person, because people learn to read you as a person. And if you are a very expansive type of pastor, and you get up, you know, and they know that Pastor Jacobus or whatever his name is tends to tell some fish stories. They've computed this as part of Pastor Jacobus's personality, and therefore they know how to modulate whatever Pastor Jacobus's interpretation of the text is. On the other hand, if you are a rather introverted, shy kind of person, when you get up to preach, if you begin becoming too elaborate in imagining all this kind of thing, it sounds phony, you know. It doesn't sound like you. You've got to keep that in mind, too. And yes, there is a danger of being far too imaginative. And I don't think we want to cheapen the text by doing that. I think what we want to do is to probe as honestly as we can. And then to say, if we have imagined some situations, and maybe we've got two or three that are rivals in our own minds for what the real situation may have been here, we may even say to the people, now I can imagine that this was the situation in this text, or that this was, or that this was, and let them make a choice, you know. I think, you know, you want to deal fairly with people. We don't want to simply run riot in these things. But the important thing is that we use our imaginations. This is a faculty that so often as pastors we deny ourselves the use of. You remember Bernard Shaw's play, St. Joan, where Joan is always hearing voices and winning battles because she says God told her to do this and God told her to do that. And some of the soldiers come to her and they tell her, Joan, these voices of yours, they're not really your voices at all. They're not really God's voice at all. These are only your imagination you're hearing. And Joan says, of course, she says, don't we always hear God through our imaginations? And I think that's true, you know. This is the way the text becomes lively for us, the way it reaches our spirits through the Spirit of God. And I think think we have to imagine. We have to be open. We have to practice. This is something we ought to have classes in, really. Lying around on carpeted floors, nobody talking, our hands against our temples, perhaps, to keep out distraction. And simply allowing ourselves to float and imagine. I remember we used to have occasional classes of experimental preaching at Vanderbilt, and one of the things we often did was to spend a while, maybe 20 minutes, at the beginning of a two-hour seminar, listening up exercises, trying to get out of our routinized way to think about things. And say, we let the students, who were much wilder than I ever was, design and take turns. And I'll never forget the time that I was with a man and wife teacher who were really rather than I did with the first of all, so I was playing with the music. I think it was the wife of the husband and wife team was taking paint and smearing it around on his stomach, and he was giggling. And he never was quite the same again. He became the headmaster of Webb School at Bellbuckle, Tennessee, which is a famous old prep school in Tennessee, and invited me down to give the commencement address one year. And I went down, and I sat there while he was making announcements and greeting the guests. And he was so impeccably robed and gowned, and his diction was so superlative. And I sat there watching him and all of this dignity and all of the setting and the occasion. And it was all I could do to stop myself from breaking out in laughter at the thoughts of him on the floor having his tummy painted. Yes. I would say, I'm no expert at this myself. I can simply say a couple of things about what I've observed in preaching to children. One of the things I've observed, which I'm sure many of you have, is that whenever children's stories or sermons are used in the context of the liturgy, that people always seem to get more out of those, even adults, than they do out of the sermon, which I think tells us something. The other thing I would say is this, that we should probably beware of over-moralizing with children's sermons. I was in a church last Sunday where there was a children's sermon, and it was beautiful up to the point where the children had made their discoveries. And then the minister, instead of listening to those discoveries and trying to amplify them a little bit, had his own little spiel that he foisted upon the children at the end, and it became very wooden and very mechanical. I think here again, it calls for imagination and for listening, for probing what's going on in the minds of the children, and being willing to let some things stand unanswered or vague or mysterious at the end, to realize that we don't have all the faith in little boxes and categories. And children can sometimes, introduce mystery to a service in a way that will stun adults if we'll allow it to be mystery and not try to turn it into a Sunday school lesson. I think that's important, too. It is important, of course, we see with children the importance of visual aids and that sort of thing. I had a student this year to do a project in which she developed some children's sermons, and she even developed the tools with which to give them. And she loved doing parables, and she would take a parable like the parable of the talents, and she would make paper money. Great big sheets of paper money or coins, great big coins. And she would have the children up front, and she would pass this out to the children and give them certain things they could spend it on and that sort of thing. And let them, they were going around the church. Some of them were spending their money for things, and some were hiding these coins and so forth. And then she told the story of the parable and just left it at that without trying to, and she was amazed to find that the children understood the scripture without much elaboration from her. Yes. That's an excellent question, because I think it comes right down the middle of where a lot of ministers face the dilemma. In the past, most person-related sermons, and most people-centered preaching in the tradition of Harry Emerson Fosdick, for example, has begun with the needs of the people and then has gone to the text. Fosdick himself had no problem with that because, as he said, he was reared and suckled in the Bible. And whenever he had a human problem to address, the text leapt out at him by the dozens. And his problem was, you know, which ones to use. Many ministers trying to use the project method of preaching that Fosdick outlined fell then into the problem of not having been suckled in the Bible as he was and not knowing the text and not being able to preach that way. Or they tended to preach on the same few problems all the time and not give the Bible its full scope. Go through the full orbit of the scripture. I think today we are beginning with an increasing use of the lectionary in various free churches, and I'm sure in the Lutheran churches, and with all of the lectionary aids that are being provided, and I think particularly the Fine Proclamation series from Fortress Press, that we're beginning to see the possibility of starting with the text and discovering the human dimension in the text, and then relating that to the human needs of our people. One of my doctoral students this year has just completed a thesis project in which he has dealt with the very business of pastoral preaching from the lectionary. And being a faithful shepherd, breaking the bread of life, feeding the people, but feeding them in such a way that their own problems and needs and joys are reflected in the sermon. And I think that probably in the long haul, if we learn to be sensitive to people's needs, then it is better to begin with the text and to use a lectionary, because this guarantees that our people receive the total story of the Bible over the years and not just isolated bits and pieces of it. I think in the long run that will be helpful. I think I did indicate that he made them feel this way. I think that I would describe it a little more positively and say that what he was doing was giving them personal insights into their involvement in the text. And if they felt guilty, all right. I think most of us would feel guilty in a setting like that, in that particular kind of thing. But I think, again, what we're aiming at is involving the people in the story of the text so that it becomes their story and it is not allowed simply to remain a text in isolation from them. Yes. Thank you for that testimony. Yes, sir.
Can you comment on the significance of the story element, the scriptural story, and the whole personal story for some of the other dimensions of the ministry? How do you see it in the ministry?
Well, I think primarily in terms of the realization that we're all living our stories and that to be faithful ministers, we have to be in touch with people's stories and with common stories. I think
It means that we have to counsel faithfully. We have to listen faithfully, not just in terms of sitting in the office and dealing with people one-on-one, but when we're at dinner parties or wherever we happen to be with groups of people, that we listen to what's happening in their lives, that we listen to the children, we listen to the old people, we listen to everybody to hear what is significant. One of my students is the pastor of a church in a kind of retirement village now. And he is learning that in order to be an effective preacher there, what he's got to do first is to learn what it's like to be an old person. He is studying geriatrics. He's gerontology. He's working with these persons, trying to get them to define what their fears are in life, trying to understand what it's like to be a single woman, 75 years old, living alone, going to bed in her apartment or her house at night, worrying about whether the plumbing is going to be all right in the morning, worrying about whether someone's going to break into the house that night, worrying about whether her children will get to come home to see her for a vacation. He's putting himself in the place of these people in order to know when he reads the text how that speaks to these persons. I think it also implies that as ministers we need to do far more reading in current literature than we often do. And many ministers feel that they're stealing time from their essential things if they take time to read a novel or go to a play or see a movie. And yet these things reflect the pulse of the time. They are, you know, a few years ago, Martin Jarrett-Kerr, one of the Anglican critics of one of modern theologians dealing in literature, said that the literary critic is like novelist or playwright is like the white rabbits that used to be carried aboard submarines that detected when there was too little air for people to breathe, and they would bring the sub up and get fresh air. Because the rabbits, being of a more delicate nature, would begin to expire several hours before persons would under the same conditions. And Jared Kerr said that the writers of any age are so sensitive. This is the reason they were writers. They're poets. They are feeling what is coming to the rest of us in advance of its getting to the rest of us. And if we don't listen sensitively to these things, then we don't really get the overall configurations of culture in our time. And we need to do that, you know. We need to have our antennae out as completely as we can so that we are picking up vibes from current culture, from the sociologists, the technologists, from Madison Avenue, and from our people. But basically, we put that together then as spiritual leaders. We put it together with the Turks during the times when our vibes, our antennae are out to God in terms of quietness and listening, when our imaginations are being sanctified. I didn't have time to deal with that aspect of it, but I think that's just as important as anything I've been saying, that you've got to be people of prayer, not just people who say written prayers, who pray out of prayer books and pray the hymns, but people who are willing to go into prayer as listening prayer and to be quiet and to allow God to come into your life the way the dew comes onto the grass in the early morning and come out of that prayer time as new persons who were able then to deal with all of the conflicting ideologies and needs of the people in your congregation. Yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, certainly. Liturgically, the prayers ought definitely to reflect this. The type of music you use in the church ought to reflect the congregation and its needs. I think it's criminal, as a liturgiologist, to inflict balk on people in a country church in East Tennessee who sing Spence Baxter and who resonate to gospel music. I think that there is no one way of doing these things, and it is only through listening that we know how to do it.
with our people. Now, granted that we may try to educate them and repeat them on a scale of aesthetics a little bit, that's our personal view. But basically, we need to listen to do that. Administratively, yes. This is part of what church administration is and what makes it different from administration in a lot of other places. That when we sit around the table as a board of elders or deacons or whatever it is in your church and make administrative decisions for the church, we're dealing with stories, with personal stories, and how the decisions we make will affect these personal stories with a kind of openness and love and redemptive character that is not always able to be present in certain businesses and things. We do it in our bulletins and the things we send out from our church. I'm convinced that one of the metaphors for being a pastor in our time is the honeybee. That the pastor is like the honeybee that goes from flower to flower, cross-pollinating those flowers, carrying this story to this person and this one to this person, and making a community out of people who are otherwise disparate and isolated. And we do every way we can, whether it's in the liturgy or in the preaching or the administration or just on our one-to-one working in the church. You got to be careful not to violate the principles of the sanctity of confession and carry some portion of a person's story that ought not to be told. I'm not talking about doing that sort of thing, but I am talking about the kind of sensitivity that is able to identify through liturgy and sermon and other ways the common bits of story that will help us to feel related to one another. Just one example, and I'm going to stop. Our time is up, I think. I happened to flip on the local television here last night before dinner and caught just a few minutes of some kind of discussion program in which the audience was involved in talking or asking questions of a panel about the way children are raised. And there was one 17-year-old girl who was in school here in St. Louis who asked one of the authorities on the panel. She said, my mother used to talk about what a close-knit family we were. And she said, then my brother went off to school, and I came here to school, and now my mother cries and says, what's happened to our family? What's happened to our family? And she said, I would like to know whether this is a common kind of thing among families, or whether I ought to write my mother and tell her, Mother, you're right, it is abnormal for us to be this way. And just in that very simple little vignette, you saw what most people were like. That most of us are living our stories as individuals in isolation from other people. And it helps so wonderfully to find out that our stories are not abnormal, that they're like everybody else's story.